A scaled-down casino near Glendale could still be good for the tribal owners. Why? Revenue sharing, or a lack of it.
You could have a situation where you could even have lower performing Class II machines, yet still be more profitable.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a historic Phoenix synagogue gets new life. The Fed's impact on consumer spending versus saving.
Preserving Taliesin West.
And why your fantasy football winnings are not real, at least in Arizona.
Fantasy sports are different because they're a game of skill. It's a totally different habit than people who go to the brick and mortar casinos and play slot machines and play table games.
Plus, the Bells of Healing are now in Phoenix, and can you have too many festivals?
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll have mostly sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon. Might top out at about 101. Should have clear skies tonight, lows in the upper 70s. And then this weekend, tomorrow should be sunny, and then chance of rain returns to the forecast on Sunday night. Quickly in Valley traffic, watch out for an accident, I-10 westbound at Central.
The Arizona Department of Public Safety says its investigation into the spate of freeway shootings along I-10 continues. But as KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, a man described as a person of interest in the case has now been released.
A Maricopa County judge ordered the release of the 19-year-old who was detained and questioned in connection with the shootings last week. The Department of Public Safety has declined to explain why the man was questioned about the shootings in the first place, but spokesman Bart Grabe says he remains a person of interest.
We still have an interest in him, but we're not at the point where we can say he's definitely a suspect, and he never was the prime suspect in this case.
The man is on probation for an endangerment conviction involving excessive speeding and fleeing from police. DPS says there have been no incidents linked to their shooting investigation since last Thursday. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Authorities say a Pima County woman who had a serious underlying health condition has died after eating tainted cucumbers. County Health Department officials didn't immediately release the woman's name or age today. They say she died while being treated in the Tucson area for an illness linked to the salmonella outbreak. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say 418 people in 31 states were infected by the strains of salmonella found in cucumbers grown in Mexico and distributed by a San Diego company. A federal judge yesterday ruled the state does not have to approve a full casino known as Class 3 near Glendale being built by the Tohono O'odham Nation. Arizona officials, however, acknowledge they cannot stop the tribe from building a Class 2 casino, the main difference being the types of machines. And Attorney General Mark Brnovich says that could lead to changes down the road.
I think it's going to create a lot of pressure for folks to start asking the question about why we have the gaming compacts. Gaming is supposed to be limited and well-regulated, and now we've seen that if Tohono O'odham Nation can, you know, disregard the compact, why shouldn't then there be gambling at places like the racetrack where the state can get some more revenue?
For more on how a Class 2 casino could affect the Valley and the Tohono O'odham Nation, we turn to Alan Meister, a principal economist with the economic consulting firm Nathan Associates. Meister in the past also did an economic impact analysis for the Tohono O'odham Nation on its West Valley Casino project.
There are differences between Class 2 and Class 3 machines. Typically, the Class 3 machines have been a little bit better performing machines. However, over time, the technology for Class 2 games has really advanced and developed. There's a lot more product available, and really popular themes that were in Class 3 have carried over to Class 2 now. So in some places, you can see Class 2 gaming performing as well, and even in some cases, even better than Class 3. It varies, though, depending on the geographic location, what type of competition there is, what other products are out there. So, you know, I can't say I'm just kind of talking about it in general.
Well, given the number of casinos that are in the Phoenix area, do you get the sense that a Class 2 facility in Glendale would be successful?
You know, I wasn't asked to analyze that, and it really is an individual situation, so, you know, I can't really say specifically. They didn't ask me to analyze that. I mean, the only thing I do know, I know that Tohono O'odham, they actually have had Class 2 machines before, and I know they've operated in the Tucson area, but they're very familiar with the product and the performance of the product. So, you know, I'm guessing, you know, that they've, you know, analyzed that themselves.
Are there places in which both Class 2 and Class 3 casinos are profitable?
You have examples in places where Class 2 and Class 3 exist in the same facilities even. The best example is Oklahoma. In the state of Oklahoma, the tribes used to be able to have Class 2 only. In around 2005, the tribes negotiated a compact by which they could operate certain types of Class 3 games. And what you noticed was that the tribes never fully converted to Class 3. They've still kept a large portion of their gaming as Class 2. And, in part, that has to do with the fact that the Class 2 has really performed very well and has been a profitable product. The other two aspects are that, one, there really is a strong following for bingo in certain places. In Oklahoma, the customers there have been playing bingo for a long time because that's the only thing that tribes were able to offer for a long while. But the other one is revenue sharing, the amount of money that the tribes pay to the state. The tribes do not pay revenue sharing in Oklahoma on Class 2. So that reduces the cost of doing business on your Class 2 machines. And so you could have a situation where you could even have lower performing Class 2 machines, yet still be more profitable.
Does the absence of table games and other card games bring in less revenue to Class 2 type facilities?
Table games generally are Class 3. Poker can be considered Class 2, but table games definitely add a little bit to a facility when you have some variety of types of games, but they generate a very small portion of the revenue and profit. The revenue, the vast majority of it comes from gaming machines.
Is it tougher to market a casino when it is a Class 2 in a market filled with Class 3?
Historically, it might have been if you're in certain markets, but with the advancement of Class 2 games and the performance of Class 2 games really getting much better and offering a lot of the same themes and products, people don't often even notice that the difference when you're playing the games. Technically with a Class 2 game, you're playing bingo, but it's typically happening in the corner of your screen, and you're playing this little game of bingo, but the entertainment value in how everything is displayed almost like a slot machine. And so you're getting a lot of the same entertainment value for a customer that's playing the machine and doesn't even really often notice a difference in the performance, especially if you can play your same kind of machines you like, but you can play them in a Class 2.
Alan Meister is a principal economist with the economic consulting firm Nathan Associates. He's also conducted an economic impact analysis for the Tohono O'odham Nation on its West Valley Casino project. By the way, a spokeswoman for the Arizona Department of Gaming says since the state does not regulate Class 2 casinos, those facilities would not pay revenue sharing to the state. The Tohono O'odham Nation, though, is expected to make payments to the city of Glendale.
The Federal Reserve is going to keep a key interest rate at historic lows for at least another month. An improving but less than stellar job market along with still low inflation are a couple of the reasons cited. The minimal interest rate has affected savings, but with the U.S. economy so reliant on consumer spending, how important is that? To learn more about the current condition of consumer confidence, we contacted Lynn Franco, Director of Economic Indicators and Surveys at the Conference Board.
What we've been noticing for the last few months is that the stock market volatility has been having somewhat of an impact on consumer confidence. But overall, what I think we see is that consumers still remain confident in the economy. There's just been a little bit of uncertainty cast over them due to this volatility.
It does seem like people were paying extremely close attention to the Fed's decision yesterday. Is that something that you think the average consumer thinks about? And could that affect what they're doing, at least for the next 5 weeks or so, until we know again what the Fed might do?
I think it might cast a little bit of a cloud of uncertainty, but we've sort of seen consumers where they are today versus a year ago sort of take into effect the fact that the Fed is going to raise rates, the question mark being just when. So I don't think that would have as negative an impact if they were not sort of aware of the fact that rates were going up.
How are spending levels at this point in comparison with other post-recession months or periods of time?
Well, we haven't seen as large a bounce back, as we had in other recessions, but obviously this recession wasn't like other recessions. So consumers were hit across several fronts, in terms of job losses, in terms of home values, in terms of financial asset values. We saw a tremendous tightening, so credit isn't as available as it was in prior years. But we have seen recently, that the consumer is spending. They are a bit cautious. They do weigh their decisions carefully. But there's nothing here to signal suddenly that we're going to see a severe pullback in consumer spending.
Based on what you see and what you study, how important is consumer confidence to the greater economy? I'm not even talking about in terms of a percentage of GDP that we can measure, but in terms of what drives the momentum.
Consumers have been very good predictors of recessions. We've seen that. So any type of a sort of a prolonged decline in consumer confidence is sort of a forewarning the economy is going to be, slow down and possibly contract. We're not picking any of that up right now. In fact, when we look at sort of the two components that make up consumer confidence, consumers' assessment of present situation versus their expectations, we see that in terms of the present situation, we remain on solid footing. It's been the expectations that have been a little bit volatile, and they tend to be a sort of a shock absorber, and I think that's what we're seeing in terms of the financial market volatility. But I think, we still remain on solid footing. We still expect, and consumers still expect, the economy to continue to expand at a moderate pace through the remainder of the year.
Lynn Franco is Director of Economic Indicators and Surveys at the Conference Board in New York. Lynn, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
So consumers are cautiously confident about spending, but what about people who want to save? Where's the incentive? Dennis Hoffman is an economics professor at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. And Dennis, how do you weigh consumer spending versus saving in the current economy?
The traditional saver, especially the senior citizen, people approaching a retirement or in retirement, have historically relied upon safe and stable interest-earning instruments like certificates of deposit, money market accounts. And those, of course, over the last 6 to 8 years are earning very, very low interest rates, partially as a result of Fed policy. But I would argue that it's only partially. I think actually the biggest driver, or one of the biggest drivers of low interest rates, is very, very low inflation. One perspective I think that savers need to be thinking about is cash is not a bad place to be. Cash earns no interest, but in a very, very low, and in some cases zero or below zero inflation environment, hey, cash is not bad to have. And so historically, savers would have liked to seen 3%, 4%, 5% interest on their money so that they feel like they're growing those balances over time.
So when there isn't really an incentive to save, Dennis, does that or should that drive more spending, as you mentioned, with inflation being low? Or do you just have some people who are on the sidelines?
Well, I think you have people on the sidelines. I have a colleague here at Arizona State that reminds many of us who have a kind of long tenured here and approaching retirement. The people of our age, one of the worst mistakes perhaps that we could make is not to have enough cash at this particular point in time. Now, that does keep us on the sidelines, out of the economy, not buying goods and services, but it's this baby boomer generation that I'm in the middle of that has really fueled a lot of spending historically. And I think it's time for younger generations to kind of pick up that pace. Clearly, we can't expect the baby boomers to be spending at rates that we saw them spend throughout much of their careers. Times are very different. I think people have to adjust to a very, very low inflation environment. And given the skyrocketing value of the dollar and the fact that energy prices are low, I think that's what we're going to be stuck with.
Dennis Hoffman, professor of economics at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Dennis, good to talk with you as always. Thanks.
And great to talk with you, Steve. Have a good day.
A historic Phoenix synagogue is being brought back to life by a developer known for preserving some of the city's oldest buildings. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman tells us, the story begins with a man named Elias Lowy, who's also known as the Jewish Schindler.
Elias Lowy was a German-born survivor, remembered for his heroic rescue of more than 1,500 Jews from concentration camps in France during World War II. After the war, he moved his family to the U.S., first settling in New York, then on doctor's advice for a heart condition in Arizona in 1948. Here's Elias's son, Fred, speaking to the Shoah Foundation, which documents the stories of survivors.
The doctor says, you must leave New York. It's too cold for you. So we rode away to different chambers of commerce in Arizona, in Nevada, Colorado, in California, and New Mexico. We asked them, are there chances for jobs and housing? They were very negative, except Arizona, they said, come on out, there's always an opportunity.
After settling in the valley, the Lowys helped establish the city's first Orthodox Jewish congregation. Following Elias's death, Fred, who had been a member of the French Resistance during the war, helped found the Beth Hebrew Synagogue in downtown Phoenix in 1955. Members of the congregation have long since migrated elsewhere, however, leaving it empty, and it eventually fell into disrepair. A decade ago, as the synagogue was headed for the wrecking ball, journalist Deborah Susser heard the story from Fred Lowy himself before he passed away in 2006.
This is a building that has significant social history because it was co-founded by somebody who survived the Nazis, because of the congregants who went here, because Steven Spielberg had his bar mitzvah here.
That's right. Adding to its lore, the famed movie director spent part of his childhood in Phoenix and had his Jewish coming-of-age ceremony in the building as a 13-year-old in 1959. Susser reported on the synagogue's historical significance in the Jewish Journal and alerted developer Michael Levine to its plight.
So Michael sent me a text message, and it was a picture of the interior. And I said, you broke in. And he said, no, I bought it.
The concrete block structure still stands on Portland Street after Levine spent $850,000 to acquire the property in March. He's adding it to a roster of renovation projects he's been involved in since moving to the Valley from Brooklyn 2 decades ago.
You're really looking at it as a ghost. I just got here in the nick of time to buy it before someone else bought it and leveled it. All the buildings that I've saved over the last 20 years were all sold to me either as bulldozer bait or they were slated for demolition.
Last Sunday evening, Levine reopened the synagogue for an informal Rosh Hashanah service to celebrate the Jewish New Year. The service was led by Phoenix lawyer and part-time cantor Elliot Tallenfeld.
Well, I read about the project in the Jewish News. I came by on a day just on my way from court back to home, and Michael happened to be here, and the place was open, and he gave me the grand tour, and then he made me stand up on the stage there and sing. And next thing you knew, I was involved.
Also involved is Phoenix native Andrew Gordon, who is president of Arizona Multibank, a development corporation specializing in giving out community development loans. He credits Levine for taking a personal interest in preservation.
Michael, in many ways, did everything to not just save the synagogue, but to bring it back to its origins.
And Levine, who says he isn't particularly religious, says he hopes reviving a synagogue is something that will be enjoyed by more than just Jews.
This is like an out-of-body experience, actually being in the building. It creates a whole bunch of dialogue of where people come from and what they're about. So it's not just a Jewish experience of people who are willing to stick it out, take the heat, and then survive. And the building embodies that.
And Deborah Susser, whose reporting helped save the synagogue, agrees.
I just think it has a lot of potential beyond the Jewish community itself. I do think it's important for the Jews of Phoenix to know their history, and for this building to be here embodying those stories, I think is critical because the people are in the architecture.
While Levine figures out the best uses for his new property, Beth Hebrew will be used again for services during Hanukkah in December. In Phoenix, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Still to come, one couple's efforts to overcome trauma.
I think people can heal faster using the arts. They're not using their head as much as they're using their heart.
Their story and a whole lot more just ahead on the show. We'll stay mostly sunny for the rest of this afternoon around the valley, still looking for a forecast high of 101. Clear skies for tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 70s. And then for this weekend, sunny tomorrow with a high of 102. Partly cloudy on Sunday with a chance of late afternoon rain and a high of 101. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%. We're mostly sunny, 99 degrees at KJZZ. One accident to tell you about, it's I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. It's blocking the center lane, causing a pretty heavy backup for a couple of miles. It's 224.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership featuring the 2015 XV Crosstrek, a 34-mpg compact utility vehicle for that go-anywhere spirit. Shop Subaru.com.
Since late last month, a not very secure slab of Navajo sandstone has threatened to break off the canyon wall at Glen Canyon Dam. And since the slab is estimated to weigh 500,000 pounds, the threat has been taken seriously. Work is being done to secure it, and officials hope to lift restrictions in the area early next month. Chris Watt is a public affairs specialist for the Bureau of Reclamation.
This thing is about 50 feet tall or high and about 30 feet at its widest, and it's about 4 feet thick at the bottom and about 18 inches at the top thick. It's Navajo sandstone, and that kind of sandstone peels away. It's been compared to an onion layer, so it kind of peels away in layers as erosion, wind and rain and snow and freezing and other nature attacks it really or runs across it. Normally this happens anyway. In fact, there are ditches and areas provided when we build in those areas so that rocks can fall. And rafters and others who work down there can report all the time of rocks falling, slab pieces of slab falling, but not anything this big in many years. This thing is about 500,000 pounds.
Wow.
Of rock.
Is there a way to estimate how long that's actually been there?
As a slab, they've been watching it since about 2005. Okay. They've been watching the cracks kind of form. And of course, we're not going to interfere with nature where we don't need to. And the only time that our folks go down there and chip away at the rocks on the wall is when it becomes a safety hazard, if it's small enough. This one was too big to just chip away.
You said it was related to nature, but is there any chance this came about because of any man-made work that was done that may have sped up the situation at all?
That's a good question. In this case, no. In fact, this kind of reaction of Navajo sandstone was noted even when it's even in some of the early notes when they built the dam, was that kind of sandstone does this. The wind gets to it, the water gets to it, and as the crack forms, in the winter, the water will get in there and freeze and expand it, and it makes the crack even bigger and those kinds of things. It's just a fact of that kind of sandstone. The canyon was formed, obviously, in the same way, just not with us around. So that stuff would still fall, just no one was there to hear it. So I assume it made a noise.
Very poetic, Chris.
Yeah.
I want to know if you can tell me how many people have been working on this. What
sure.
What techniques, methods, expertise do they have to have? And is there a risk? I mean, one would think, I'm sure all safety precautions are taken, but the way you describe the way things are set up, this is not just, hey, we're going to do a little hammer and nail. It's a nice, easy job.
No. It's a pretty amazing job. And the guys who do this are pretty amazing folks. These guys rappel down the rock, down the canyon wall. They're on ropes. And while they're on these rappelling ropes, they drill into the rock through the slab and into the wall to insert bolts that are about anywhere between 8 to 14 feet long. They're 1-inch diameter steel bolts. They've put in about 50 bolts besides the first six. What they've been able to do, too, over the last few days is, along with putting in bolts, they've been able to kind of chip off some of the lighter pieces around the edges. their hope eventually is to get the whole thing down safely. But what they can't chip off safely, they'll secure to the wall.
Chris Watt is a public information officer for the Bureau of Reclamation. We've been talking about the Glen Canyon Dam slab, not boulder. It's a slab. Chris, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
National Drive Electric Week is drawing to a close. Advocates of electric cars have been talking up their benefits across the country. Numbers from the U.S. Energy Information Administration released last year show Arizona had 1 to 2 electric vehicles per 1,000 registered vehicles. That's in the top half nationwide. California and Washington State led the way. For more on Arizona's place in the electric vehicle landscape, we turn to Will Tour, Transportation Program Director for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project.
One way that Arizona really stands out, certainly among the states in the Southwest, is in the benefits that accrue from electric vehicle use. Because Arizona has one of the cleanest electricity mixes in the nation, and certainly the cleanest electricity mix among Southwestern states, the air quality and carbon pollution benefits from electric vehicle use in Arizona are really very high. When it comes to kind of the policy side and to the number of electric vehicles that are actually, you know, being purchased and driven on the road in Arizona, I'd say Arizona is doing a respectable job, but not in the very top tier. And I'd say we see something similar when it comes to the number of electric vehicles that are being used in Arizona.
So in your mind, policy-wise, what does Arizona do well and what could Arizona do better?
So one thing I think Arizona is doing a great job with is using high occupancy vehicle lanes to incentivize electric vehicles. And I think that is a very effective incentive to help people, you know, make that step to a new technology. One of the policies that Arizona has in place that, while well-intentioned, I think has not been very effective and could be modified to be much more effective while actually saving the state money is a financial incentive for alternative fuel vehicles. Right now, Arizona has a reduced license fee for alternative fuel vehicles, including electric vehicles. But because it's a reduction in a fee that is paid for each year, sort of over the life of the vehicle, turns out that's not a very effective incentive. That what really matters is the incentive that you have up front.
In general, how much do the policies that a particular state has in place impact the number of electric vehicles that residents of that state buy?
You know, policy seems to make a big difference. If you look at the very top states in the nation, so places like Oregon, Washington, Georgia, interestingly, is in that top tier, you have the percentage of new vehicles that are electric vehicles is more than 10 times higher than the level in the bottom states that have no support for electric vehicles. So we see a really, really big impact there. And then if you overlay on that some of the cities in those states where there's really strong city support for electric vehicles, there are places where we're seeing, you know, already 15% of new vehicles being electric vehicles. And as I look at a city like Phoenix, where I think there's been, you know, some good support for electric vehicles, and certainly there's been a lot done to install electric vehicle charging over the last several years, Phoenix and Arizona strike me as the type of place where, with a little bit more of a push from both state and local government, we might see something really great happen.
In the past, it seems that electric car manufacturers really liked having their vehicles in places like Arizona because the technology seemed to do really well in the heat as opposed to being in some places where it didn't get so warm or was far colder. Is that still the case?
It is certainly still the case that when the batteries get really cold, the range does suffer. So I do think that a state like Arizona is a good state for electric vehicles. Now, the other thing that we're seeing is that as battery technology sort of continuously, incrementally improves and the range of the vehicles gets, you know, longer and longer, I think that will become less and less of a concern, and we will see less of an impact from climate on which states really work well for EVs.
Will Tour is Transportation Program Director for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project, or SWEEP. Will, thank you.
Thank you very much.
They were there after the 2011 shooting at a supermarket in Tucson that left former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords critically injured, and they were there after the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut.
The show's Anika Klein brings us the story behind the small bells hung in the face of hardship and why they're now also chiming in Phoenix.
You might hear one while walking outside. A simple metal bell tied to a ceramic flower, and at the top, a note.
You have found a Ben's bell. Take it home, hang it, and remember to spread kindness throughout the world.
That's Suzanne Cohen, a volunteer here at the new Ben's Bells location in downtown Phoenix. But the nonprofit has its roots in Tucson. It was founded in 2003 by Jeanette Murray after her 2-year-old son Ben died unexpectedly.
And that threw my family into this just incredible grief process that I don't think anyone can be prepared for.
It was during this process that Murray began to make the bells. It started as a relaxing activity to do with friends, but soon a few bells turned into dozens. By the first anniversary of Ben's death, it was hundreds. Murray and others hung the bells around Tucson in Ben's memory.
And honestly, at that time, we had no idea that it would turn into a thing.
The bells became something of a local phenomenon. Other people discovered them and shared their stories. Liz Tomko is an art therapist and says sometimes art can help when speaking about something is too hard.
One is so cognitively based and the other one is so core based. So I think people can heal faster using the arts because of that. They're not using their head as much as they're using their heart.
Murray recruited volunteers and they kept hanging bells. Hundreds in the Safeway parking lot where Representative Giffords was shot. Another 1,000 in Newtown after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary.
It just had this sort of force, and we just went with it, and now it's 13 years later, and 47,000 Ben's Bells have been distributed.
And 4 studios have opened, the latest in Phoenix. On a recent First Friday, the studio was filled with volunteers and people who stopped in to find out more about Ben's Bells. Studio manager Christy Brown says anyone can help make a bell.
We say about 10 different people, by the time a bell goes out into the community, have had their hands on it. So it's a really cool symbol of coming together.
Here's volunteer Suzanne Cohen.
In this busy city, everybody is so impersonal. We're past people on the street. Very seldom does anybody say hello. We need to remember we're all in the same boat and to be kind to each other.
The bells made here will also be hung around Phoenix, with a big distribution tonight during the studio's grand opening. This time, not to mark a tragedy, but to commemorate a new beginning. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Still to come, there are dozens of festivals in the Valley each month, but how many is too many?
People love having things to do, but I think we're approaching kind of maximum capacity.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for. One is I-17 southbound at Camelback. The other is I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. That one's blocking the center lanes and also causing a pretty heavy backup for a couple of miles. Valley weather for the rest of the day, we should stay mostly sunny and reach a potential high of 101 degrees. And then for tonight, clear with lows in the mid to upper 70s. Start the weekend tomorrow with sunny skies and a high of 102. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%. Mostly sunny and 99 degrees at 237.
KJZZ is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, presenting the new PBS documentary, On Two Fronts, Latinos in Vietnam, airing Tuesday, September 22nd at 10 p.m. on Arizona PBS.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The House has voted along party lines to block federal funding for Planned Parenthood for a year. Another abortion-related measure was also passed today. Neither bill is likely to become law, though, over opposition by Senate Democrats and a veto threat by the president. GOP Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn says the freeze on funding makes sense while Congress looks further into undercover videos released by activists claiming to show violations of laws barring the sale of fetal tissue for profit.
A one-year moratorium while we do our due diligence. That's what you call smart business. Doing your due diligence, being a steward of the taxpayers' money.
But Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor says the videos were heavily edited to discredit Planned Parenthood.
What has emerged since the false videos were posted on YouTube is a coordinated, broad-based smear campaign based upon false, manufactured videos that are full of distortions and misinformation.
House GOP leaders are hoping the bills will appease conservatives who've pledged to block funding for the organization, even if that means triggering a government shutdown. The Environmental Protection Agency says Volkswagen intentionally sidestepped clean air laws by installing software in about a half million of its diesel cars that reduced emissions, but only during testing. Assistant EPA Administrator Cynthia Giles.
Put simply, these cars contain software that turns off emission controls when driving normally and turns them on when the car is undergoing an emission test.
Giles says VW has been ordered to fix all of the cars. The automaker could also face billions of dollars in fines. The company says it's cooperating with the EPA, but is declining any further comment. Stocks lost ground today on Wall Street. The Dow closed down 289 points at 16,384. The Nasdaq was off 66. The broader S&P 500 index lost 32. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good afternoon in KJZZ News. The Phoenix Fire Department's three special operations teams have responded to more than 1,100 calls for aid this year. Larry Shaburvi is with the department. He says the number of calls is on a normal pace for the year. Many of those are for the department's technical team, which specifically responds to mountain rescues. The department has seen a 10% increase in those calls, and that's taking a toll on the team.
It's extremely exhausting, and they carry up to 50 pounds of equipment because they carry ropes and litter baskets. So they're not just hiking the way somebody would hike up with just a water bottle. So it's very exhausting work. It's very taxing work. It's one of our highest firefighter injury type work.
The team had to make a total of three consecutive trips up two different Phoenix mountains last weekend. One of those rescued, Shaburvi says, was very close to death. He says an increasing number of rescues to which the department has to respond have included fatalities.
Republican Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona says he's boycotting Pope Francis' speech to Congress next week because of the possibility the Pope may discuss his support for policies to fight climate change. Gosar says as a Roman Catholic, he initially was excited to learn of the Pope's visit to Washington and his address to Congress. Frank Lloyd Wright's historic impact on architecture, including here in the Valley, is far-reaching. Wright has been in the headlines more than five decades after his death as a battle continues in the Arcadia area of Phoenix about how to preserve a home he designed for his son and daughter-in-law. There are also some preservation challenges at the Wright-designed Taliesin West in Scottsdale, and that brings us to Fred Prezzillo, Director of Preservation for the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. Fred, why is it so important to preserve Taliesin West and the unique locale it's in?
Wright, when he first came to the desert in the 1920s, he just kind of fell in love with that strong power of the desert. It was so different from the lush rolling hills of Wisconsin where he grew up. When he started developing Taliesin West, he wanted it to really feel connected as if it just grew right out of the desert and was there for all time. You know, he was testing his principles and his theories on architecture at Taliesin West. You know, this idea of the open floor plan that is really quite common today in our homes. When Wright started practicing architecture, this was a new thing. It was a real break from the conventional design. Taliesin West is really important because this was his laboratory, and this is where he worked on all of those things and tested his theories.
What are some of the unique aspects of preservation on a desert site like that? Because this has been there for many decades.
Wright always called Taliesin West his camp in the desert. When he came here, he was really, he was really one of the first snowbirds. You know, he was coming here every winter from Thanksgiving to Easter. He would come here and he would camp and he would explore how to really live in the desert Southwest. He was looking at how do you enjoy this beautiful environment that we have here in the winter? How do spaces where you live day to day kind of interact with your environment? So some of the major challenges that we have working on National Historic Landmark here in the desert are just really that harsh environment. The sun is hard on building materials. It's really hard on the wood and the paint. Everything at Taliesin West is custom. It was all built by his apprentices, this idea of learn by doing. They learned architecture and building by actually building Taliesin West.
Are there some changes that need to be made that you've been trying to make that still keep the actual spirit and what's going on intact, but things that have to be adjusted because we're in the 21st century?
You know, we have some infrastructure issues that we are working on to update. When Wright purchased the land in 1938, he asked them to throw in the water rights. So he received the water rights for the property. He drilled a well, and it's the same well that we use today. But, you know, that infrastructure over time in the desert has met really its useful life. And, you know, we're having to go through and replace a lot of the water infrastructure. Mm. So, you know, when we do that, it poses some challenges in that the desert is really important to Taliesin West. It's integral to the buildings. And so, you know, we don't want to go through and rip up all the desert and destroy that beauty. So how we place infrastructure and still maintain the beauty around the property is a challenge.
Do you ever feel like you want to be in a bigger hurry to get these things done, to feel like what we just talked about, some of the changes that you'd like to make, some of the updates while preserving the spirit? Does that ever feel like, well, I mean, everybody knows this is such an important site. Can't we get moving faster?
Yeah, you know, I walk around and I, you know, with a very critical eye, and I'm looking at the property every day and wanting to accomplish these things. But preservation is not something that you hurry. There's a lot of research that goes into what you do so that you can make the right decisions for the building. Sometimes we wish we can get through it right away, but it's a process. There's a process of research and understanding the building so that you can make the right treatment to it to preserve it.
Fred Prezzillo is Director of Preservation for the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation.
As you're making weekend plans, you may have noticed that now more than ever, it seems there are an endless number of festivals for you to choose from around the valley. This weekend, for example, you could go to Brazilian Day, Funk Fest 2, the Rock and Taco Street Fest, and at least three more. Here to talk about this is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark.
So why are there suddenly so many festivals, and what does that mean for the Valley's art and cultural scenes?
That's a great question, and I think the other big question is, when do we hit that point of festival oversaturation? Like, who can go to six festivals in a weekend?
I stick to one or two at most.
Exactly. So I talked about this with Becky Bartkowski. She's the culture editor for Phoenix New Times, and she thinks we may be getting close to that tipping point.
I think we're approaching the burst of the festival bubble. They've been building up and building up and building up over the past few years. And it's great. Like, people love having things to do. But I think we're approaching kind of maximum capacity.
What do you think happened in the last few years that caused all of a sudden this surge?
I think part of it has to do with people seeing the monetary success of festivals like Coachella, where you have all of these musicians coming together, but then you also have food vendors and you have people coming in to sell t-shirts and records and whatever, and seeing that and wanting to replicate it. I think it's partly that, and I think it's partly people wanting to find out more about the niches they're interested in and being able to.
So, you know, you did say, like, hey, it's a great thing. People are getting out. They're getting into their communities. They want to put things on. They want to be out and engaging with these kind of niche communities that they see themselves as being a part of. But you also said the bubble is about to burst. So how do we know when we've kind of hit that point of oversaturation?
Well, I think there's so much going on that there can be a point of almost too much to choose from. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's part of Phoenix growing and Phoenix learning about who's here. What are people interested in? What can we do here? Can we pull off this arts festival? Can we pull off this food festival? But festivals, personally for me, are exhausting. I couldn't go to a festival every weekend if I had all the energy drinks in the world. And I don't know if there are enough people to justify multiple festivals every weekend about all these different things. But I guess we'll see. I could be wrong.
So you also mentioned the massive success of Coachella and the way that it has kind of expanded into this. It's its own thing, and it's changed a lot from what it was when it first started, and people really wanting to replicate something like that. I wonder, you know, if you think it would be more beneficial for Phoenix to really try to focus on making one festival or two festivals, just like really huge, iconic Phoenix festivals that people come from out of town to see, making, I don't know, for example, something like Summer Ends huge and really popular, or if that is something that will not work for us, like what would it take for us to have a Coachella or a Lollapalooza? And is that something that we should want?
I mean, I think those are great things to aspire to. I think that music festival wise, we could have our own signature event. And I mean, like you said, Summer Ends, huge. Kanye West is coming. All of these banner artists are coming. And I mean, it looks poised to be a really well-attended and exciting event. So I think aspiring to Coachella and Lollapalooza levels is a great thing to try for, but I don't know that that particular thing could happen in Phoenix. It's not impossible. I could see something like Viva Phoenix continuing to transform and kind of morphing into a bigger and bigger and bigger event. It's not impossible.
That's Becky Bartkowski, the culture editor for Phoenix New Times.
Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Quick check of Valley traffic at 249. US 60 westbound, the HOV lane at Mill Avenue is blocked. I-10 westbound, the center lane is blocked at 43rd Avenue. Also accidents, I-10 westbound at 27th Avenue and I-17 southbound at Camelback. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 101. It's 99 degrees right now at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Landings Credit Union, helping kids learn about money with youth accounts because one day they'll need a car loan, a credit card, and a mortgage for a new home. LandingsCU.org. Landings Credit Union. Banking with purpose.
It's not the biggest in town. You might even say it flies a little bit under the radar. Hollywood stars who make their stops in the Valley certainly hope that's the case. Its history goes back to wartime. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us the story.
The Scottsdale Airport averages about 140,000 departures and arrivals a year. They're mostly private and corporate planes. Did you know Scottsdale Airport was an Army Air Corps aviation training base during the Second World War, known as Thunderbird Field 2?
This was primarily for U.S. aviation cadets.
Joan Fudala has written extensively on the history of the Scottsdale Airport.
This was in the middle of nowhere. From our founding in 1888, Scottsdale through World War II was just a really small farming and ranching community centered in what is now downtown Scottsdale. And this was far north of where any development was.
Thunderbird Field 2 opened in June 1942. Its boundaries were around what is today Frank Lloyd Wright Boulevard to Thunderbird Road, and from about Scottsdale Road to the Pima Freeway. The runway was a flat, graded area, and the closest air marker was decidedly low-tech.
The McDowell Mountains came in very important as a navigational aid to those cadets. And in fact, Pinnacle Peak Mountain at the north end of the McDowells became a really important nav aid. Years ago, I interviewed several of the cadets that had trained here, and they said without Pinnacle Peak, they may not have found their way back to Thunderbird Field.
Budala says while U.S. cadets were trained here, all of the other airport workers were civilians, actually Scottsdale residents. During that time, the base became the largest employment center in the area. Thunderbird II closed in 1944. During the 2 years that it served as a military aviation base, an estimated 5,500 cadets were trained here. After the war, the land went through a series of owners, from Arizona State College to the federal government, and by 1953, the Seventh-day Adventist Church purchased the land.
The tower control and cadet facilities area was converted into what is today the Thunderbird Adventist Academy.
The Adventists realized they had way more land than they needed, so they offered the landing area to the city of Scottsdale to open up a municipal airport, which the city did in 1967, and that became Scottsdale Airport.
A few of the Thunderbird Field 2 base hangars still exist today in the area where the school is located. The airport landing strip has been paved since then, but the angle of the runway is very similar to what cadets used to train on during World War II. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know things we should know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org.
The National Football League season is in its second week, and college football is well underway. And with apologies to other sports and even fans of reality shows like The Bachelor, this is the time of year when interest in fantasy sports intensifies. I'm taking a break from football this season, but Mark, you're playing.
Yep, it's another season for the Auto Draft All-Stars going for another championship. I actually have one, I think one, in my lifetime. It's a small league with no money at stake.
Good thing, because Arizona is one of five states in the country where if you play in a national online fantasy sports league, you can't legally claim your prize. And recent legislation to change that didn't reach the end zone. To learn more, we talked with Stacey Stern, general manager of Head-to-Head Sports.
You can play fantasy with your friends as long as there are no entry fees, nobody's putting any money into a pot, for example, and as long as nothing's being risked. But because Arizona is an any chance state, and if you're putting up something that is of value to play for something else of value, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a cash prize. It could be something of a few hundred dollars worth of value. Technically, that's breaking the law. And where this all stems from is because Arizona is an any chance state, there's also a 1998 Attorney General opinion that talks about fantasy sports. And it was kind of in this realm of talking about poker and liquor establishments. Mm-hmm. And then they brought fantasy sports into the fold. And this gets tricky for fantasy sports companies in Arizona because the idea was that the participant who's playing fantasy sports have to participate in the actual game. Now, what's the actual game? Mm-hmm. Is it the fantasy game where you're picking your roster, or is it the NFL game or the Major League Baseball game?
1998, though. That's 17 years ago, and the industry was so different then. I mean, now these ads are ubiquitous, whether it's locally based leagues or these huge national leagues. So it seems like this could be a time to change things. Is there any momentum to change the law?
I think there is. You know, last year we had legislation introduced on behalf of the Fantasy Sports Trade Association. And what the Fantasy Sports Trade Association is a group of member companies who are looking to advocate for fantasy sports in general. So we had Adam Driggs, who's a state senator, and told him about fantasy sports for prizing not being legal in Arizona. He didn't have any idea, like most people, I would say. So he really wanted to take up this issue because he believes, like I do, that people in Arizona, residents of Arizona, should be able to play fantasy sports games because they're games of skill. Mm-hmm. And they should be able to win prizes.
Does the moral question ever come up on this? It's still a matter of getting into something where you're putting money out there and eventually, well, maybe that leads to a gambling problem and people worry about that.
I just think that because the skill that's involved, I don't really know what would be different than if I went to Dave and Buster's and put in money for one of those little dancing games, you know, because I'm such a great dancer, and used my skill there and then won some tickets and could get a prize. Because I happen to take the time to put together a lineup based on watching games that I love to watch. Mm-hmm. And maybe I think I've got a leg up on somebody because I know information. You know, the ability to put in and risk money, I understand that that's a risk. But I think that's my choice and my decision mm-hmm. as a consenting adult, if you will.
So how many states at this point allow this?
45 states currently.
Of the 45 states, did many of them get on board 15 years ago? Have there been some recent developments? And is there anything that would stand out to you about what those 45 believe that the other five don't?
Kansas is a state recently who took this issue up and said, is the daily fantasy sports game gambling? Is it a game of skill? They looked at it pretty closely and passed a bill that said it is a game of skill, which is really great to get that clarity. Some of the states have older laws on the books if you look at the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act carve-out, that's a lot to say, from 2006. And this is, if you remember, when the poker sites had kind of that Black Friday and the feds came in and said, no, can't do this, and you can't use your credit card or debit card. We, as Fantasy Sports, got that carve-out to say, fantasy sports are different because they're a game of skill, and they're playing against other people, and it's based on more than one real-life event. There are states that are looking at their laws saying, does this cover daily fantasy sports? Michigan, Florida, California.
There's been controversy over the Native American gaming things as far as casinos. Is that where the opposition's coming
from? That's
it. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that this is something that we are going to be able to all agree upon in the next couple of years. I do. I have hope, because I think the more that we educate people involved with tribal gaming that fantasy sports is not a threat at all. It's a totally different habit than people who go to the brick-and-mortar casinos and play slot machines and play table games. And in fact, I think that it can really enhance what they're doing.
Stacy Stern is general manager of Head to Head Sports.
So, see, very important fantasy football-related questions.
Yes.
When you're picking your players, do you care more about their performance or whether they are on a rival of your team?
I really don't care about the rival of my team anymore because, Mark, hopefully the IRS is not listening. It's all about winning money. It's all about the money.
Just not here.
No, as my dad and the guys who were on Watergate said, follow the money, okay?
That is fair. It's always a kind of a philosophical debate for me. This year, Tony Romo is my quarterback.
And you're a Giants fan.
And I'm a Giants fan, so it's really, especially last week, just it made my head hurt just a little bit. If fantasy sports isn't your thing this weekend, you can check out Bob Saget. He'll be performing a stand-up at Stand Up Live in Phoenix tonight and tomorrow.
Now, is he by himself, or are John Stamos and the Olsen twins there too?
I think it's probably by himself.
Okay, well. ASU men's football. Odd to be playing on a Friday night. They're hosting New Mexico. That's at 7 at Sun Devil Stadium.
Also, the Phoenix Symphony opens its season with Beethoven Symphony No. 9 tonight and tomorrow.
Furious George, the cover band, playing tonight and tomorrow at Fort McDowell Casino. Not to talk about Furious George too much. I think of Curious George.
Yes.
Is there a band that would come to mind?
I don't know.
That covers Furious
Just
George.
Just make a lot of like Man in the Yellow Hat sounds. I'm not really sure what
exactly.
That's about.
Exactly. Good point.
Also, one more thing that Steve and I will probably be partaking in this weekend: the World Arm Wrestling League State Championships. It's tomorrow night in Mesa. You want to go?
My sleeves are already rolled up. Back off, big man.
Let's do it. The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
And we want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're always open to those. We're at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ, FM Phoenix, and HD. We hope you have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.